I know. Okay, if we could start moving back to our seats, that would be wonderful. And there'll be coffee coming after the break. Very ineffectual.
Okay, we're going to get started with this next session. So this session's entitled Insights from Alternative Approaches, but I really see it actually as an extension of the discussion that began under Ross Matsueta yesterday with the question of what more do we need to understand, because several of the issues that came up during that session I think will be revisited here. And the way that I think about this session is there's kind of three strategies that we've been talking about throughout yesterday and to this morning. One is the idea of linking somehow criminal justice involvement with ongoing surveys, general surveys like the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, for example, Fragile Families, and we'll hear a little bit about that. The second is to somehow link data to ongoing criminal justice surveys, particularly Jody mentioned the National Corrections Reporting System, and there's also the inmate and prison inmate survey, jail inmate surveys that BJS Ann talked about yesterday. And then finally, this big issue of linking administrative records, be it on incarceration to health or health records to incarceration or other forms of criminal justice involvement. So the order, we're going to go a little bit out of order in terms of what's listed. We're going to start with Amanda Geller. In terms of measuring incarceration and fragile family study. From there, we'll go to John Boyle, and then we'll visit two surveys. Elizabeth will be representing the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, and Dave Johnson is going to join us to talk about the PSID study, panel study of income dynamics, and Jim Lynch is going to, I had him batting cleanup, but now he's going to bat fifth, which is okay. And you will wrap up and pull everything together and lead us forward into the 21st century. So with that, why don't we start with Amanda?
Thanks, John. Okay, so there are sort of two purposes or two things I want to do with this presentation today. I want to give you guys an overview of the Fragile Families Study and the way incarceration and criminal justice involvement are measured in the Fragile Families Study, but I also want to talk a little bit about a pilot linkage project that we did, and that was using data provided by the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services. New York is one of the 15 states that is sampled as part of the Fragile Families Study. They were extremely helpful in providing data, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we go. So just to give you a quick overview of Fragile Families itself, it is a birth cohort study of 4,898 families with children. So 4,898 children born in 20 large cities between 1998 and 2000. And the study was initially designed to look at the role of fathers in families, particularly in non-marital childbirth families. And the way the study was basically conducted at baseline was that women were recruited into the survey from the hospital within a few days of having given birth. So these were brand new moms. And they were then asked after their survey if the father of the child was at the hospital, and if so, could they speak to him? And the father was consented. If the father was not at the hospital, then do you have contact information for him? And he was contacted for interview. So both mothers and fathers have been followed up four times. There have been five waves so far since the focal child's birth. So parents were interviewed again when the child was one, when they were 3, 5, and 9. At year 9, we also interviewed the children themselves. At year 15, we're currently in the fields. The kids are about 15 now, and we are interviewing the mothers and the children. We didn't have funds to continue to follow up with the dads, unfortunately. And in the 15 or so years of the Fragile Families study, the range of topics being covered has expanded substantially as well. The way that criminal justice involvement, what I've heard anecdotally, I wasn't involved in the study at the time, but the way that it got worked in was that at the first wave, when the mothers were asked, can I talk to the father, about 4% of them said, well, you can't because he's incarcerated. And that was, it was the first follow-up study where we went back in and formally asked about criminal justice involvement, because it wasn't until the baseline that the prevalence of incarceration in this population became so clear. Another thing that I forgot to add here, but there's a systematic oversample of non-marital births. So about 3/4 of the births in the study were to unmarried parents, which gives us a sample that is predominantly low SES and predominantly minority. So all of those factors contribute to making Fragile Families really useful for the study of incarceration in families in a lot of ways. So we have a, as I said, a largely disadvantaged urban sample, and about 50% of the fathers have some indication of incarceration indicated at some point in their lives leading up to the 9-year survey. What's particularly useful about this sampling plan, though, is that in addition to having a large sample of incarcerated fathers, we have a large sample of fathers who have no reports of criminal history, but also have other socioeconomic disadvantages. So it's a very useful comparison group. Incarceration can be indicated either by the father or the mother asking about the father. There are also questions where mothers can self-report their own involvement in the criminal justice system, and where fathers can report on the mother's incarceration, but I'll focus on the fathers for this purpose. The other thing that makes Fragile Families so useful in terms of identifying outcomes of children with incarcerated parents is that most fathers who are incarcerated are non-custodial, potentially non-resident, and may not be connected to their children in administrative data sets. As a household survey and as one that surveys mothers as well as fathers, this provides an opportunity to link these men to their families and find out more about at least one of their children. So, these are the beginnings of the measures that we use to directly indicate incarceration. And you don't need to read through all of the detail, but I'll put it up here, and I just want to call your attention to a few different things. The first is that fathers and mothers are asked different types of questions in order to indicate the father's incarceration. So at every wave, the father, and actually in mother self-reports, it's always the self-reporter is first asked, have you been booked or charged with breaking the law in some time frame? So the first question is, have you ever? And then it's, have you in the last 2 years? And then only if they say yes to that question are they then asked about conviction. And then only if they say yes to that question are they then asked about incarceration. So that is what the self-reporter is asked. What the partner is asked is basically, is your partner, what is your partner doing right now? And being incarcerated is one option. And then they're also asked, has he ever spent any time in jail or in prison? So if they're not there now, they're asked if they ever have been. So the partner report is a much more inclusive measure, but it's a much less detailed measure. So if somebody is picked up on a low-level offense and spends time in jail awaiting trial, the mother will report that, but the father will not self-report it, because if the charges were subsequently dismissed, then he's never going to be asked about whether he's in a correctional institution. The other thing I'll point out is that there are some complications in the way the questions were phrased. So the mother questions, she's asked, has he ever been incarcerated twice, first at year 1, then in year 3. So we don't know at year 3 We know if she's reporting a first incarceration, if she says he's ever been incarcerated before. We don't know if she is reporting a new incident or another report of the same incident. And one other thing I'll point out is that at year 9, the questions about, you know, have you in the last period of time is a little bit more complicated because we say since your last interview. And if people had skipped an interview, then that needs some kind of computation to go back and work out. So those are the main indicators that we have of whether there is any criminal justice involvement among the fathers. I refer to these as direct indicators because these are simple yes-no questions. There are also places where criminal justice involvement can be indicated indirectly. So at every wave, there are questions like, if you're broken up, then why did you break up? If you aren't looking for a job, why aren't you looking for a job? And there are a handful of parents at each case that say that incarceration was the cause of some other circumstance in the family. In most cases, these people also directly reported, but not always. So we include these indirect measures of incarceration as well in terms of identifying people who have some history of incarceration. So for So for the people who report directly, there are also some opportunities to elaborate and provide more information about the incarceration experience. So they're asked, fathers are asked, or self-reporters are asked, what charges were you convicted of? How much time did you serve in total? When were you most recently incarcerated? When were you most recently released? Mothers are also asked some follow-up questions. Unfortunately, these are not the same questions that the father is asked. So I think most, and Chris can, you know, tell me if he knows of counterexamples, but I think most of us who use the Fragile Families Study don't really use most of this data other than some of the timing questions in order to figure out, is this a new report of incarceration or is this a previous report just being reported a second time? All in all, and I talk about this a little bit in my demography paper from 2012, about most of the incarceration experiences that we're able to identify in the Fragile Families Study, we identify from the partner questions because response rates are higher among the moms than they are among the dads. And you know, we have a lot of cases where the mother, and also given the skip patterns in the father questions, we have a lot of cases where the mother reports an incarceration incident that the father may have either not been interviewed to answer about or skipped out in the previous points of questioning. So what we wind up doing, given that we have some of these inconsistencies in question wording and some of the inconsistencies in terms of responses, is I think the general literature in Fragile Families says if there's any indicator of incarceration, we assume that it is accurate and that the person has a history of incarceration. There are a lot more incentives that somebody might have to underreport than to overreport. So if we have any mention of incarceration, we take that as an indicator that the father has an incarceration history. We have done some work to ascertain the timing of incarceration so we can separate people incarcerated before the year one survey, between year one and three, year three and five. I think most people who work with the year nine data look at the year one to year nine interval rather than five to nine because of some of these question issues, but we can get at some of this timing if we want to do some sort of get some sort of causal estimates. This gives us an opportunity to look at pre-incarceration characteristics for some of the families. Another thing I should mention on that, though, is that since we first ask about incarceration at the year one survey, most of the fathers are already in their late 20s by the time they enter the survey. So most of the people with incarceration histories have already had some incarceration history by the time they're asked for the first time. So we can do some pre-post analysis, but in most cases, we're getting the effect of a marginal kind of additional incremental incident rather than the change in status from never to ever formerly incarcerated. But given all of the outcomes we can look at, the connection of men to the families, I mean, we've really been able to move what we know and kind of advance the conversation along a lot. But that said, we started to look at what else we could potentially learn. So I got a seed grant from Columbia to do a data matching pilot. And what we did was we took the 300, so there were 384 fathers that were part of the New York City sample. Kids were born in a New York City hospital. We took as many of them who we had identifying information for as we could, and we submitted the information to DCJS after a lot of working through the human subjects protections and the data protections and things like that. And we were interested in figuring out if the official records could adjudicate some of the inconsistencies between father and mother reports, if the official records provided more detail than we could get out of the survey reports, and then also if we had some over-reporting in the survey that wasn't picked up in the administrative records. So we were able to match based on the father's name, social security numbers, date of birth, and I'll just give you sort of the summary of what we find. We found a lot of consistency in the mother and father reports, at least in the Wave 1 survey. And we found that when parents agreed, almost all of them were supported by the administrative data. There was a record to back up the parent reports. When there was disagreement, sometimes there was a record, sometimes there wasn't. But I'll keep this short and we can talk more about it in discussion, but one of the biggest surprises and challenges that we encountered with this data match is how much reporting of incarceration we had in the survey that didn't show up in the administrative records. So we were able to identify new fathers that had shown up in the administrative records that hadn't shown up in the surveys as having been incarcerated, which I think lend support for this inclusive measure that if we have any indication, it's probably an indication of true incarceration. But we submitted 337, I'm going to skip this for now, just kind of leave it up there. We had 333 fathers whose names were submitted. We only got records back on 77 of them. And some of that is indeed that some of these fathers had no criminal histories, but what I really underestimated was the extent to which records could potentially be sealed. So if charges were dismissed, records were sealed, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't some time spent in jail or some disruption to the family or threats to the father's well-being. I understand why the records were sealed from a personal privacy protection. I think it's probably a good thing that these records are sealed, but in terms of treating administrative data as a kind of panacea to correct for underreporting in surveys means that it's not going to be comprehensive. Records were also sealed if an arrest for a felony or misdemeanor was resolved as a non-criminal violation. Some of the other work I've done looking at policing and following arrests picked up from street stops in New York City finds that most of these arrests are resolved as non-criminal violations, so a kind of minor arrest for disorderly conduct. So that's not going to show up here. So I'm going to just close at this point so the other panelists have a chance to talk, but it just kind of raises the issues of, you know, I think that the matching did teach us a lot and it taught us a lot about kind of how we should interpret the survey data, how we should interpret mismatches, but that there are also a lot of challenges in doing the data linkages to really have a good understanding of what these administrative records include because they're not going to be fully comprehensive and we need to understand where the shortfalls might lie.
Thank you, Amanda. John?
Thank you. Unlike Amanda, I have no slides because Elizabeth said I couldn't have any slides. So when I was given this charge to be one of the people talking about alternative approaches, my reaction was I've directed or overseen 50 to 100 surveys per year for about 35 years. And out of that, maybe 3,000 surveys, I never did a survey related to incarcerated individuals. So why am I here? We did, in fact, in all those surveys, which were mostly health-related, they're for the federal government, they also deal with violence and so on, the only time you see incarceration is going to be related to things like a list of stressors, traumatic events. Sometimes it'll come up under occupational issues and so on, but there's very little there. Nonetheless, I think over 3,000 surveys, I can pull out a few lessons, about six with my time, that may be helpful in thinking about alternatives. The first point, actually, Amanda stole my thunder. Right now I'm overseeing 8 to 10 breakfasts a year. We oversee the Youth Risk Behavior Survey and so on. But I'm not sure you're ready for a cross-sectional survey for the various issues that you've got in front of you. And part of the reason goes back to the second survey I ever did, which is called the Longitudinal Harlem Adolescent Health Study, which at least calls itself the first community-based sociomedical study of health problems of teenagers. This study was begun in the late 60s as a one in six household study in Central Harlem Health District. The individuals were 12 to 17 who were found in those households. They were followed for 25 years. There were five waves. I came in on the second wave, and I also basically oversaw the fourth wave. And we learned some, I think, fairly interesting things. First, it is an age cohort rather than a cross-section. One of the values in doing something community-based, particularly if you're picking a high-risk community, is you start dealing with some of the issues related to low incidence and sample size. You're picking the area that is at risk so that the proportion of the household sample, the individuals found, are going to have a higher likelihood of these things and a larger subsample size. The other issue is that if you pick them as an age cohort from the same area, you've controlled for age. Also, if it's from the same area, the issue of counterfactual or comparator is a little bit more sensible. Those who are and those who aren't from the same general area, who we won't say had a treatment effect, but had an intervention effect, if you will, right or wrong. But the household selection for this prospective study is really important because tracking these people over time, by the second wave, you no longer had a strictly household sample. You know, first you had the people within 5 years who were incarcerated, who had joined the military, who were in the hospital. And the really striking thing is the proportion of people that you found at wave two and wave three who are no longer attached to a household. They were floating in the community. The way you found them is you went and you sat on their doorstep and waited till people who knew them came by and you got some clue that, yeah, right now they're camped out at Uncle Billy's, or right now they're at an SRO over someplace else. On a community-based study, you can actually do that kind of location, which is very hard to do on a national study. And it also allows you the logistics that if you really want to do physical measures and specimen collection, logistically, it's a whole lot easier to do that. I know that because on the fourth wave, we got a contract to do the interviews. And once we had the contract, they told us, and by the way, we'd like you to collect blood too, which was quite a surprise. So we trained interviewers. I'm sorry, we trained phlebotomists to be interviewers, and we did it. So I think a prospective community-based cohort would be terrific. But since some of you look a little more impatient about getting some data that would be useful, your next best shot is a retrospective health study where you've got a sampling frame to begin with. And a lot of the stuff that I've done that's been related to epidemiological studies, the sampling frame we begin with very frequently was in some way, shape, or form related to the Vietnam War. Because basically we found people who were part of the Army Chemical Corps, were part of the spraying operations for the Air Force in Vietnam. Got into some of the amazing experiments that we did with that cohort during the war, including it. Well, never mind. The good news is that if you begin with a sampling frame that was intact, at least at the point where the intervention begins, you can actually track mortality. You know, with the location efforts, we know what proportion of this sample is at this point, 25, 30 years later, dead, what proportion are institutionalized, what proportion we may or may not be able to find, who are homeless, and then there's some portion that we don't find who are going to be rootless, like my people in Harlem. And part of the issue is tracking it down. The great thing is, when people like David and I started doing this stuff, location was a nightmare. You know, now, particularly since you can no longer do it door-to-door all the time, the tools of location are just massively better, and it's part of the administrative records, and so that's terrific. So you probably don't want to go forward with, you know, waiting for another war, using the current wars or things like that. But one of the things you might want to think about is I would not recommend trying to convince CDC to take the YRBS and turn it into a longitudinal study or add questions about violence and criminal behavior and so on, because it's going to risk keeping the institutions involved in the study. But you might want to think about going back and on a community basis or multi-community basis, creating a retrospective cohort by taking schools at a certain point in time and being able to identify what's fairly readily available, who were the freshman class of a high school or whatever, and using that as your cohort going forward to locate those people and identify where they are today. You're not going to have the data on where they were then. Probably the administrative records are going to be sealed on test scores and stuff like that. But bottom line is, like our Vietnam veterans, we know where they were then. It's a community cohort or it's a school-based cohort. And if we look at them now, we can see who is and who isn't and what happened and find out who's missing and how many of them were missing from the non-institutionalized population because they're institutionalized. Sort of an extension of that is if you look at the other thing that's great about our Vietnam experience is, if you're not aware of it, one of the really cool research things they did way back when is they created a twins registry. And the counterfactuals that were being raised earlier, you know, who's the comparator? Well, way back when, they identified 15,000 pairs of twins in the military, and we've done a whole series of studies over the years comparing the twin dyads on gambling, on alcohol use, on drug use, on post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm not aware, in fact, we've even got studies of kids of alcoholics. I'm not aware that they've done any study specifically related to criminal justice behavior, but there you get to sort out nature versus nurture with a relatively large sample over a period of time. There's a series of other twins registries that have been developed over the years, and you might want to look at some of them, particularly the newer ones that basically are not related to wars that have been over for 30 years. Winding up as quickly as I can. I think the non-response bias that I think Marcy was talking about is a big deal. You know, I mean, it's not only that the frame is a problem, but even when we've got a good frame, who you're able to find because they want to be found, who are willing to be interviewed, and who are willing to tell you something that's accurate is all an issue. And one of the reasons it's an issue, I think, particularly here and more so in a lot of other things, is we who have done this survey stuff as our profession have really, like Blanche DuBois, you know, thrown ourselves on the kindness of strangers. We want you to do this for social utility. And the real problem is social utility works for some portions of the society better than others. It's one of the reasons why, aside from we were talking down there, cost, that Brian has allowed incentives and things on studies, is that not everybody is going to do it for social utility. And particularly when you try in the whole issue of trust and trust of governmental institutions, I think you got to think seriously of non-response bias and whether or not just using the tools that we've used in the past are appropriate to this population. And I will end by saying something that came up the first day, which basically was, Wendy was sort of asked, where'd you come up with those questions? And the answer is, like most of us who began in health or criminal justice or whatever, we frequently began with the questions that somebody else wrote, and you know, and now they're validated questions. You know, and for no better reason than everybody agreed that they were okay. You know, we began with them. You've got a great opportunity now in moving into this area where we don't have that much data. We've got a lot of places to go to really take advantage of formative research to get the right questions. One of the great things about where we are now is that you can do cognitive testing, but with, you know, you can grab some non-prob samples and you can do relationships between variables and multiple ways of doing it before you start getting ready for real data collection. And I think that's a terrific opportunity. And one of the things that I still think is amazing is going back to Marcy's study, the National Health Interview Survey. If you ever go back to the 1950s in your time machine and look at some of the cool studies that were done in the early 50s before they launched, testing what people knew and understand with these wordings. I mean, what proportion of the population doesn't understand what hepatitis is? You know, it's very sobering. And I think we really ought to do some of this here. We might want to do something like David was talking about, time-bound questions. Don't ask them when they were in jail or prison, but just how long. You might want to think about, instead of the double barrel questions that we love, you might want double anchored questions, where you basically say, you've been in prison for 6 months or longer, or you've been in jail for a week or 30 days or longer, something like that that gives them two anchors, the name and basically the time frame that you're looking at, and you might get more accurate data. Because I will end by confessing that apparently I would be in the incarcerated, not incarcerated, I would have been in the criminal justice thing, because when I was in college, I was selling encyclopedias in Southern Illinois and was arrested by the police and taken down to the station and kept there for hours, looking in a cell and being told that I would only be released once the company came and basically bought us our freedom. And we would have criminal records and we would have to come back, you know, to go to court afterwards. So I guess I'm here.
Just follow up on that, on John. We have a medical exam outside if we'd like to take it. We're going to be a case study. We'll do a case study. Elizabeth.
Thanks. Alien abduction.
Okay. I don't have any slides either because he told me that I couldn't have slides. It's only like Trump now, right?
Yes.
Okay, so the National Longitudinal Surveys. I'm really only going to talk about the National Longitudinal Surveys of Youth, but they're, as you'll see, they're complicated, they're long-lasting, and we have a lot of information that differs depending on which survey you're talking about, and I'll just give you a few numbers. So actually what struck me at the very beginning of the meeting yesterday was when Glenn Martin said, he was talking about Arthur, who he shared a cell with, right? And he said all the different experiences that created and shaped Arthur. And I thought, oh, that's a, you know, that's the terrific first line for where I'll start, because let's start with the NLSY-79, which started in 1979 with 14 to 21-year-olds. And they have been interviewed every year through 1994 and every other year since. So we have just come, we're now working on cleaning the data from round 26. And for the first time, we've dipped below 80% response rate. We're at 78 point something, which is great, right? So why do we have such great response rates? Well, in part because we got these people back in 1979, and we still get them, and we can still find them. And there's this sort of guilt thing, you know, well, you've answered before, so come on, keep answering. And a lot of them are either what I would call perfect responders or perfect responders minus one, where, I mean, I'm really talking very large percentages have responded to either every single survey or every single bar one. We also do try and get into the prisons. So when they are incarcerated, we try. I'm not going to say we get every prisoner. It has just taken the last 6 to 8 months to get into the California prisons, and I found out last night that we think we now have permission to go in for the, I'll explain about this in a minute, the 97. We're very dyslexic with the LSY. You're either a 79 or a 97. And it's taken that long to get into the prison. So that is not an easy thing to do, but we do interview in prisons. Okay, so back to the 79, we started out with over 12,000 individuals. We started out with oversamples of Hispanics and non-Hispanic blacks, with poor whites, and with military personnel. Unfortunately, the socioeconomically disadvantaged white sample was dropped, and the military oversample was dropped due to lack of funding, but we still have oversamples of some of the minority populations. All kids in a household aged between 14 and 21, so you have siblings in there as well. And this becomes important later on, because not only do you have siblings, but as you'll see, if we go into the next generation, that means if those siblings were females, we have aunts and we have cousins in the data, which I'll come to. It's primarily a labor survey. Started with funding from the Department of Labor and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But NICHD has, well, and other agencies, but primarily NICHD has put a considerable amount of money into the survey. There are a lot of health questions there. In the 79, there are relatively few incarceration or criminal justice questions, but there are some in there. And there are good health. There are basic health questions throughout. And at age, I'm not sure if it starts at age 30. I think it starts at age 40. Is a extended health module. Thank you. How many people have used the NLSY 79? Great. Good. So you can fill in for me when I get confused between the different studies. Super. And an age 50 health module. And there will be an age 60 health module if we can keep going that long. All right, so then we have all the children born to the women. And the child study started in 1986. In fact, at the population meetings in two days' time, we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of the child study. So these are all children born to the women. So this is where I was explaining a little bit yesterday about how when you have incarcerated parents, we may be able to get at some of the effects on children through existing data. And these children have been followed, most of them since birth. Only those, obviously, who were born before 1986 wouldn't have been followed from birth. But the mothers have always been asked about prenatal behaviors and behaviors during pregnancy as well as since birth. And the kids have been tested. The kids have had a whole battery of questions. As they reach age 15, they become young adults, which as a parent of two daughters, I don't think 15 is when you become a young adult, but that's what we call them anyway. And so they have been interviewed. Some of them have been interviewed. I didn't actually work out how many times. A lot of times. A lot of times. Our oldest is 44 and the youngest is 4. So we got a great spread of ages there born to women who were 14 to 21 in 1979. And then, and this has all been funded by NICHD. All the child collection and all the young adult collection data has been funded by NICHD. So again, we have very good health data in there, including data on asthma, for example, and other things that have come in at the time. All right, and then the one that most the cohort that most of the criminologists know is the 97, the NLSY 97. And these were kids ages 12 to 16 in 1997 who were followed every year through, I think it was 2011, and now they're on an every other year schedule. They have been primarily in-house surveys. They're just now transitioning to primarily phone interviews. This year, they're currently in the field, and this year it's I think roughly a 25% phone rate, 75% in person. The next round in 2 years' time, those percentages will be switched. And both the children and young adults and the 97, we still have over an 80% response rate of those still eligible, right? We do trace when they've died, so they're out, and when we don't try and, you know, communicate. Mm-hmm. And we also have, when oversamples have been dropped, then they're not there. But basically, we are at just over an 80% response rate. And we're doing round, 16 or 17. I'm so confused as to which one's about to go in the field, which one's being fielded, which one's being...
Does it make a difference?
No, it's a lot. Right. Good. Okay. So just to give you an idea, in the 97, I just pulled up some information because I'm not a criminologist, so I have not used these data. But I see that we have 6,451 variables to do with crime. Now, you have to remember that a lot of those are variables, for example, on arrests and dates of arrests. So you have beginning and ending dates, arrest dates, and we have event histories. So you know when somebody was arrested and if they went to jail, how long they were in jail for, and if they were incarcerated in a prison, how long in each month, what was their status. So just as you have with all sorts of other arrays, we have some of these arrest arrays and incarceration arrays, and that makes up a lot of those variables, okay? We also do create some summary variables, and I'm just going to read you just a very few. So we've got the earliest arrest date, the total number of arrests, the earliest incarceration date, the total number of incarcerations, age at first incarceration, length of first incarceration, length of longest incarceration, total months incarcerated, and current incarceration. And every time there's a new data collection, those variables are updated, created because obviously the idea is to get as many people as possible to use these data. So the 97 also, this came up from yesterday and I wasn't sure, so I was doing some quick emails back to the staff in Columbus, and we do also have questions on other people who've been incarcerated in the family. We are experimenting now with permissions to be able to link certain pieces of data. But I was thinking as I was sitting through yesterday's presentations, and talk came up about the kinds of prisons that people were in. Well, we have the information on what prison they're in. We may be able to link to some of those, create variables that would, again, it's that fine line between bringing in all sorts of other data elements and yet still being able to ensure that the respondent cannot be picked up in the data if nobody knows who they are. Yes.
If I may ask, because yesterday's discussion also talked about perhaps the importance of distinguishing between prison and jail.
We have that.
So those questions allow you to do that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. As far as I know, because I got a note from... Where is it? I have a note from Sean Bushway, and he was saying
From Sean,
it's good, right? I think that's what he told me. If I'm wrong, I will correct myself, but I'm pretty sure. That's just a really quick, brief overview. But we are one of those longitudinal surveys that does have health data and quite a lot of health data. We do have a lot of incarceration data, these different surveys. The 79 has obviously information from two generations. And let me just give you, of course I didn't provide any slides, nlsinfo.org is a good website to start. There you will find ways in which you can have questions put onto the various surveys. If you're talking about the children and young adults, given how much information we have on their parents, you can just contact me directly at cooksey.1@osu.edu. And also, if you just have questions in general about adding to any of the surveys, also feel free to contact me directly.
Thank you.
Stop there.
Thanks. I should have had slides just to say that in 5 minutes I can put slides together. But so I'm going to talk about the panel study of income dynamics. So we've been around 1968, 5,000 families, following them over time. So we have a huge longitudinal, the longest household longitudinal survey in the world, so almost 50 years. But the key is we follow the split off. So we'll, if you're in the family and the household and you have kids and the kids leave and start their own household, we'll follow them. So we have like 1,200 three-generation families where all three generations have been as either a head or a spouse and interviewed in the survey. So it's a huge longitudinal. We also do things like modules. So we get funding from National Science Foundation, National Institute on Aging, and NICHD for the questions, but depending basically on the age of the group you're looking at. So even though we also have this core that goes over this 50 years, we've had surveys where we go out and interview the kids. So every 5 years, we do a child development supplement to interview the kids and their caregivers and a lot of stuff on the kids. Every other year, we've gone out and interviewed the young adults, so people who are transitioning to adulthood. So some of these people may be living in the household still or may be going off and not a head and spouse of a new family, but a young adult household. Then we'll get other funding to do special surveys. So I think the key one for you is we did a childhood retrospective circumstances survey funded by NIA. So we're focusing on older people. And we went and asked them, since age 26, you know, were you ever arrested? Did you have probation? Did you go to jail? And the offenses of that. So those are all there. And about, I looked it up, there's about 188 people who reported they were ever in jail since age 26 in there. We've also, that's basically the survey. So then when we have a lot of health records, but again, this is self-reported health. So it's I guess you're calling it the subjective health versus the objective health. So we'll have, did you ever have diabetes? Did you ever have these conditions? So we'll go back and collect that information. But again, it's not confirmed by health reports. We've started to collect saliva for about 3,000 people. Most of them are families with kids because it was paid for by NICHD. But we haven't evaluated the saliva and we haven't looked at blood or those types of things. In terms of prison time or jail time, and I think our questions are prison or jail, so you can't separate out. We used to, back 85 to 92, actually follow the people when they left the household and went to jail, and that we ended. So now what we'll do is we'll go back and they'll say, well, what happened to that person in the household? Well, they went to jail or not. So we'll sort of know that, but we don't have much. That's not in the public file. That's sort of on an internal file. In 1995, we asked whether you ever went to jail, so we can look at those. And that's sort of what Rucker Johnson looked at. He looked at those families whose parents ever went to jail and then the outcomes of the kids. And then in 2014 is when we had this childhood retrospective circumstances survey where we have these families that said ever done jail. And nobody's ever used that. In fact, it's embarrassing. So there's a lot of stuff here, but if you look, search our bibliography, there's only four articles that pop up when you search for crime, jail, incarceration, or all of those types of things. So there haven't been many people who use this data. So I think there's a lot of stuff to do. In terms of the transition to adulthood survey, so these are the young adults, 254 of them have said they've ever been in jail. So that's a fairly large sample. So if you're looking at sample sizes, I do know that there are people who've evaluated the PSID with samples of a long, big balanced panel of over only 700 people. So that is possible. You can look at this and get results. But I think what I would suggest is, again, I'm a firm believer in this administrative data linkages. So I worked with Census for a long time and pushed it. We link to HUD records. We link to Medicare claims records. We're trying to link to Zillow. We're trying to establish a contract with Census to bring the PSID there so that we can linkage to the Social Security records, the 1940 Census, ACS, other Census data as well, and exploit that idea. I do not think Census has a lot of the crime data, but if BGS gave them all the crime data, we could link to that. The key is, again, on consent. So we ask consent about specific things, but we have a broad, you know, sort of like NHANES, there's a broad statement in there. We're going to link to the other data to do statistical analysis. So the key is how direct do we have to be when we tell them we're going to link to their crime records, or how direct do we have to be if we're going to link to other records at Census? I think that's the key issue. But I do think that's where we should move to. In terms of collecting actual health data, we've talked about this, of whether we could, again, have NHANES trucks go to our PSUs and pay people to go and use the NHANES trucks. Again, the issue is going to be consent and going through the IRB. But I don't think that's an impossible thing. I think it's just extremely expensive, and that's the key. So it's more of how big a sample do you need, right? How much health do you need? I think those are the two big things. So I think that's enough for me.
Thanks. We're going to end with Jim Lynch. And for those of you that don't know, Jim served as the director of the Bureau of Justice Statistics, so he has an intimate knowledge of all the statistical holdings within that agency. And also he's thought a lot about this issue of linking data to administrative records. So, Jim?
Thanks, John. Almost everything that John said is not true. So I'm here because Bill Sable is out of town, and I think I did him dirt when he was my deputy, and so this is his payback. So I'm going to say some things about what BGS is doing that hopefully will be helpful. And there's a phalanx of much more knowledgeable people against that wall from BGS, primarily Ann Carson, Alan Beck, who, when I go off the track, they can write it. So I want to talk about, I am interested in this issue, something related to this. For many years, Bill and I did some work on collateral damage. I think we started in like 1992, when before it was fashionable, before Todd Clear got hold of it, and stuff that, so where we began to look at the effects of incarceration on collectivities, families, communities, so on. So we're looking for a way to, so that's been an interest. So, and I ran into many of the problems that everybody has talked about here, and I'm sure you talked about them yesterday. So, but I'd like to talk to two things. One is I want to talk about the NCVS, I should say, the National Crime Victimization Survey, partly because I wasted a lot of time on that about a decade ago trying to address this question, and I have to say something about it somewhere. So we're going to talk about that. The second thing goes to the thing that Dave was talking about and other people, which is to say the efforts that BGS has underway for building the statistical infrastructure for using administrative record data. And those are the two things that I'd like to talk about. First, let me talk about the NCVS. I think the folks from Bowling Green, I don't know where you are. You're here somewhere. I missed it yesterday. You know, 3 or 4 years ago, we got together and talked about a similar kind of. And when I was first looking at this, I said, how do you measure a 1% phenomena in a sample survey of any reasonable size? You don't. You know, so you can stratify your brains out. You can do a whole lot of things, but I mean, as Alan, I think I talked to Alan a little bit this morning about this, and he said, and I posed that question, he says, what do? You get a really, really big sample. And if you think about the surveys that we're talking about, you don't have. Fragile families is not a big sample. And LSY is not a big sample. So the base rate of this phenomena and the amount of selectivity that's going to be in it is huge. Okay, so, and I say that saying nothing's perfect. So everything I'm going to talk about has more problems than what they've talked about. But this idea of getting a small, preferably longitudinal survey to study these phenomena and cramming everything you can into it. That's the way we've been doing things because they're such a rare, it's such a rare event to get these vehicles, you know. And so what happens then is you want to stretch that dependent variable. You're going to let, if someone's been in a lockup for 10 minutes, you want them in there because you got to get those numbers up. Okay, and then what it does is water down your relationships afterwards. The other thing is because you can't get enough people, you begin to analyze the data in a did you ever kind of. So you treat incarceration as an attribute, an enduring attribute of a person, not as an episode, you know. And so you need a big survey and a big longitudinal survey to treat these things like episodes. It could be that the effect of an incarceration goes away in a month. So you're only going to pick it up if you treat it as an incident and not as an enduring characteristic. So all of these things are going to water down the effects of incarceration that we find in the populations as we relate it to other forms of damage, I think. So the reason I approach the NCVS is because it is a big survey. It is 90,000 households interviewed twice a year. That's a large survey. You know, even in a large survey, a 1% phenomenon is going to be, but it's going to give you bigger numbers than Dave is squeezing out a PSID. You know, you get 188, you can accumulate the NCVS for years and get those numbers up. So in that sense, it's a useful tool for this kind of thing. It doesn't have much health data on it worth a darn, but it has other things that are useful. I mean, when you bring up the idea of collateral damage, you have to address the idea of collateral benefit. That is to say, first, when you remove somebody from a household, is that good for the household or bad for the household? You know, we talked about bad, but there's always somebody lurking there saying, I don't get beat up anymore. And you have to address that issue. The NCVS gives you some purchase on the ability to address that issue. Not the way I did it, you know, but it's conceivable that that kind of thing. So it's not a perfect longitudinal design. It's a rotating panel design. So houses are in there for a certain amount of time. There's going to be some bias in the rotation out and so on. But it still has data on crime, and it has data on interviews everybody in the household. Many surveys don't do that. You can ask those people about damage that has occurred to them. So it's not the perfect vehicle, but it has a few attributes that I wouldn't take it entirely off the table. I can say this just to get Bill in trouble, because then he'd have to fend you guys off, or Jerry. Now it's when, yeah, anytime. So when you guys come making demands on that, on access to the survey. But it is a, they did have a crude way of measuring incarceration touching a household. And that had to do with the questions that the interviewer asked about people who were on the roster at time one, not on the roster at time two. You had to explain to the interviewer where they went, mostly because it's a non-institutionalized population. So if you've rotated into an institution, they don't feel compelled to, you know, follow you or include you or whatever. So they had a series of questions about people who entered the household and people who left the household. And we used those to begin to identify households touched by incarceration. And so it has both entry and exit. Clearly those are inadequate questions. They have to be, I don't know if Dave has presented on that yet about how to ask about that stuff, what we picked up was a lot of old folks is what we picked up. So did people move from the house to an institution? And we got a bunch of, we got, I don't know, 500 or 600. We aggregated over a number of years, and we got 500 to 600 households touched by incarceration using this kind of measure. And then we realized that, because we looked at the census of institutionalized people, and they said 90% of the institutionalized population are in prison. The rest in medical care facilities and old folks' homes. I don't know what the difference is, but but as I get older, I'm beginning to appreciate it, I think. So, and that was fine for the stock, but we were dealing with flows. So people go to old folks' homes, the average stays 2 months, they die, that's it. Prisons stays a lot longer. So old folks are 10% of the stock, they're 50% of the flow. So we got less people than we wanted to. But so I got that off my chest, and that's an...
Jim, can I just, since you're putting BJS on the line here, what about the idea of doing supplements that would capture health?
Yeah.
To link to some of these...
I say that, Jerry's over there looking daggers, but I mean, in principle... As an independent actor, yeah.
Okay.
There are supplements all the time to the NCBA.
I know. And there's others that should be done, but that's...
Well, only if you want to discontinue the survey entirely.
How does the funding work?
Like measure gun use and things like
how
that.
How does funding work for supplements? Is that...
The question was how about funding for supplements.
When I was there?
Yes.
The supplements can be funded by external folks, as are the education. The school crime supplements are funded in part by the Department of Education. And some things like the police public contact supplement are funded by BJS itself.
Right. And NIJ did some identity theft, I think, in coordination with BJS as well.
Alan's about to fall out of his chair, but that's okay.
So they never break even, by the way.
I knew he'd get that one in. So,
but just think about how much fun you have.
So let me say, I just offer the NCVS as a flawed vehicle. It's a large national sample with a longitudinal component and some interesting information on crime, which you're not going to find anywhere else. So it has a ton of problems people talk about here. So the other thing, and more promising, I think, is the efforts that are undertaken largely and under Ann's division and the corrections division, linking BJS collections, identifying prisoners, and linking that to other sources of data, including health data. People, I'm sure, is Amy O'Hare here yesterday or somebody from the CARA? No. Oh, okay. So everybody knows about CARA?
No.
Okay. Too bad. They had. No, CARA is, I think, is a really interesting program that Census has undertaken, understanding the potential utility of administrative records and the explosion of data collection, including in the criminal justice system where people are recording things they never recorded before, and that Amy's the Center for Administrative Record Research and Application, it's called, and the idea was that people would contribute data sets to the center. The center would link them with other data sets behind the wall, ensuring confidentiality and working hard to get the kind of linkage that only Census can get because they have access to all the information that they suppress when they give data to the rest of us. And so I think it's a terrific model in the sense that people who contribute get to use, and that's a great thing. Other people get to use. It's not so easy. It's an arduous task to get behind the wall. But it does awaken to the fact that you have you can start to link all this administrative record data. And so BJS, Bill sort of pushed the idea of investigating this linkage, because you could think about, I remember Howard Snyder telling me that in the criminal history record, some of these guys had 18 different Social Security numbers. So if you think that Social Security number is a terrific linker in this population, it might not work so well. So it's very important to think about how good the usual linkers can be to this kind of population. So there's a data collection that Alan Beck began many, many years ago, which is the National Corrections Reporting Program, which is a record for every release and every admission to state prison. I think that is where BJS started looking at this business. So linking, can you link those admissions and releases to other administrative data, some of it on health? And so the first question was, is it any good? So I think Ann sent some things over. In 2015, they collected Social Security numbers in a number of states. So they would have date of birth, name, Social Security number as linkers. And so they tried that, and they had pretty good success with that behind the wall. They went on to test multiple years which did not have the Social Security identifier, and there too, there was pretty good success in linkage. So I think, you know, in terms of finding out if you can link to other federal data available behind the wall, I think the answer is yes. You can do that at pretty high rates. And so that may be one source of data to do the kind of thing that Dave was talking about within the confines of the center that Amy runs. So I think that they have not explicitly linked it to, I think, Ann, you linked it to the Center on Medicaid and Medicare data.
So we're behind CARA, they only have the enrollment files. So that's a project we want to look at in the future. Our people have people up.
Sorry. So behind the CARA firewall, they only have Medicaid and Medicare enrollment data currently. So we want to look at that to actually link it to patient treatment files from CMS. It's a completely different process we would need to go through, and it's expensive. So that's a future thing when somebody leaves us lots of money.
Thanks. So there's one source of data to get the correctional status of people. And obviously, when you're doing this, you're not going to have the zeros, right? All you're getting are the corrections people. So the benefit of those large-scale surveys is that the ones and the zeros, and you can do your analysis that way. Here, you're going to have to find the zeros someplace. That's your problem. I think the second source of data that talks about that BGS is looking at here is the inmate survey. Reportedly, every 5 years, BGS is supposed to do Alan's not listening, but he's supposed to do a survey of inmates. So they take a sample of 14 to 17,000 or so inmates, and it's supposed to happen every 5 years, at least in the good old days, and the same is done with jails. So you interview that population and you ask them a lot of questions about themselves and about their conditions of confinement and other things. So it's a program participation, these kinds of things. So it's sort of a wealth of information. So if you're trying to characterize the correctional experience and you're trying to distinguish jails from prisons, well, even within prisons, you're going to have quite a variable experience. And so these data sources are pretty useful for identifying and breaking out this experience in different ways. It's not perfect, you know, but it does give you more data on the prison experience to help you differentiate it from other kinds of experiences. And the idea here, the question then is, can we go behind the wall with the inmate survey and link it to other things, link it to the criminal history data, link it to other health data that you might find or others. So, and the first step in this, of course, is to get permission from the inmates, and I think they're in the field now. And according to Ann, I think they're in a situation where they've had very, very few refusals. Something about being in prison that makes you extremely compliant. Evidently, it's sort of that's why John. That's where you study the overlap. There's an old fight between John and I. So, this is another potential source of data, and to allow you to investigate and differentiate the correctional experience, I think, and then expand that to health data by linking it behind the wall. So we know the first hurdle is that we are getting participation, so you'll have the permission to link. And so that's another potential source of data that may be of use in the long run. The last, I think, and Amanda talked about this a little bit indirectly, is the criminal history data. Al and I were talking about this morning, but when I was at BGS, I wanted to do an arrest report using the criminal history data. The FBI data on arrest, very incomplete and so on, and they don't have a lot of detail in it. And so I said, well, we've been building these criminal history records, $500 million or more, over 20 years or so. Can we get any statistical use out of them? And so here is another instance where you may be able to get some statistical use. Yours is a sobering study in this regard, but the matching of administrative records with survey records is really precarious because there's error on both sides, and a lot of times it's just definitional differences that knock you out. So this is something that you really have to investigate. But Exploring the utility of the criminal history data for this purpose has not been done. They've been used for recidivism studies. That's how Howard Snyder and the has used them in BJS. And so, but not for this kind of research. And so, according to Alan, there's sort of this, and some of the things from Howard, that you have two strengths to the criminal history data, the arrest part and the correctional part. You know, the stuff in between, they're working on at this point. But you're interested in correctional populations. I think the idea of using this instead of the NCRP, for example, as a way of identifying correctional experience and giving would be an interesting thing to pursue. Again, these data are owned by the FBI. And so access to these data, the NCRP are owned by the states. So access to these data will need to be negotiated. Not that BJ hasn't done it for individual researchers, but that's not their principal job. The principal job is to do national statistics. And so when it comes to a trade-off between getting you the data and continuing the relationship with this state, guess where they're going to go in that sense. But that doesn't mean you can't do it on your own. So those are the kinds of things that I think the kind of statistical infrastructure that's being built that presumably can feed into some of the work that you would like to do. And there's a lot of work needs to be done and laid out some of that work. And I think that the whole idea of getting access, streamlining access to researchers, you know, we're having this problem in Maryland. We're trying to build a data analysis center in Maryland. And to take all the administrative record data from the bureaucracies, eventually go into the health bureaucracies, but not for a number of years, you know, match it up, clean it, you know, try and make it available to people to use without going through, every new researcher goes through a year-long vetting process to get these administrative records. These things should be expedited so that this statistical infrastructure is made more readily available to people. And I think that, I'm not sure that's BJS's job, but there's a demand for that kind of public good. If you guys have a report to make, if you can sneak that in, that'd be great. So I'm sure the BJS guys are about to come off their chairs, so I'm going to stop. And that's about it.
Thanks, Jim. Just one quick question about the criminal history data. Is there enough data there on disposition that you'd be able to look at whether or not there are corrections? Or I thought there's a lot of missing.
You don't care about disposition. Disposition is iffy. I think right. The entry into correctional institutions is not.
Okay.
Okay, if they come into a correctional institution, Alan was telling me the other way, they have biometrics at that part and the arrest part. So the data should be pretty good there.
Okay. You know?
And it's not so good in the middle.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to break around 12:15, is that right, instead of noon? Okay, so first I'd like to just give an opportunity for anybody that spoke to respond to anything that you've heard, and then we'll open it up for a spirited discussion. Yes?
I was just going to add that, no, we don't have lots of incarcerated people, but apparently there's about 750 individuals in the NLSY 97 with incarceration, who have been incarcerated. And apparently there have been about 400 articles and dissertations written using the crime data in the 97. I don't know what's been done matching to the health data. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But I would, since when they reach age, they're in their mid-30s now, roughly, early to mid-30s, and when they reach age 30, they have an extended health module. So that might be an opportunity to at least get some of what you'd like to do done before you can get things onto other surveys.
Anyone else? Well, it seems like there's a couple different strategies here. I mean, clearly one is secondary analysis of existing data, PSID, more on National Longitudinal Survey of Youth. I think also funding Amanda to continue to push the fragile families data in many ways. We also could think about this idea that John mentioned about a retrospective community survey to possibly get some information. And then finally, we could partner with BJS and Jim Lynch and get them in trouble and see if we could exploit the existing holdings within the Bureau of Justice Statistics to push us forward. So I think there are a couple different clear strategies here that we could use. But I just want to open it up to anyone who comment or questions for the panelists or anybody here. Candace?
I'm struck by the fact that the national household surveys of health that are estimating the health of the United States leaves out millions of people because they're behind bars. And it would seem to me, I mean, I don't know, maybe this is a naive question, but is there any way you can get access to doing these health surveys in an institution so that you really have more accurate estimates of what the health of the country is? It's kind of like Becky Pettit's book where she talked about, you know, we estimate high school graduation, we leave out all these people who are behind bars, and we estimate changes in the employment rate, and we leave out all these people who are behind bars, but if we really had that data, it looks quite different. And we could say the same thing about health.
You could, but also there are a number of statistical agencies in the federal government, and each has been carved with a specific mandate. And ours hasn't really covered... I guess there's just been traditionally this division of labor that's existed. And we do best what we do, which is, you know, for household surveys. If we were expanded, if our budget was incredibly increased, I mean, certainly we could expand, but you can't do everything on the budget that we have. You know, you're talking about, it's a big population to you, but when you're talking about the general population, it's a small population to us. And I think it was articulated very well by a number of people that if you're looking for a rare population and then you're trying to understand their health, and this is a very varied group. It's not, you know, they're not homogenous, so... You need to have enough of a sample to be able to do your analysis with. Otherwise, you've spent a lot of money trying to add questions and find people, and then you can't do anything with the data because there aren't enough of them to make to do good analyses on. I think that it's of course we all agree it's very important to study them, but it's you have to do it right. Mm-hmm.
There are some data existing, so deaths in custody, for example. Deaths in custody will give you some information on deaths by certain types of illness. I think the BJS has been doing some work to see how good their reports from the institutions are, and they turned out to be pretty good, you know, in that sense. So there is that source, and there is the survey of inmates that, but that doesn't have a great big health component to it. Is there anything different now?
Let me say a few words. First of all, the exact figure is about 1.5 million in prison on any one day, not millions and millions. When it comes to jails, well, the difference with jails is they're in for a very short period of time. So those household surveys can pick up individuals who had some jail experience during a calendar year. Now, somewhere around 9 million people flow in and out of jails during the course of a year. On any one day, it's about 750,000 who are in a jail. So the flow is substantial. You can pick up the health issues from a household survey for that jail population. When it comes to medical issues and healthcare issues, you know, the inmate surveys are capturing data on self-reported problems and self-reported experiences of receiving care. So it's not medical, you know, specimens, but it does give you a window on what inmates either bring with them to prison or have acquired since coming to prison. And when it comes to mortality, I think the mortality data are very, very fascinating, because we're finding mortality rates that are lower in prison than are in a comparable population outside of prison. And the same holds true for jails. And it has to do with health care being provided for the first time to people who haven't had health care before. Now, there are two exceptions to that. One is a liver disease. mortality for liver disease is higher in an incarcerated population than in a non-incarcerated population, and it's and sepsis, death due to sepsis, higher in prisons and jails than outside. But all the other measures suggest that perhaps inmates receiving health care in ways they haven't received before.
Yes.
One of the things that struck me yesterday as people were talking was the concept of trajectories. And it seems to me that when you limit a household survey question to what happened in the past year, you're really ignoring the whole group of people for who had contact with the criminal justice system earlier in their lives at any point before the past year, and what impact that has. And it's you're losing a lot by not knowing more about the person's history. And to do that well takes several questions, probably more than five. So I'm just wondering what you're really getting with a one-year look back.
Well, there's a lot of different ways of answering that. I mean, there's a practical, you could ask in one question rather than the multiple questions you're talking about. And also, I do sometimes worry about the retrospective bias, particularly if you're trying to capture, what are you trying to capture in terms of that number of incarcerations, length of incarcerations over multiple periods of time? But I mean, they're like all research, there's the trade-offs in terms of where we're at. So, yes.
I just wanted to add, I mean, we're one of those surveys that sort of has a little bit of each, because we ask about their experience in the last year, but then we also ask about ever. And I could imagine building on that basic structure. The 12-month question is essentially to be able to map and correlate with other recent health behaviors and HIV risk behaviors, drug use behaviors, pregnancy experience, relationship status, all of these things that we have in our survey to get, because we're all about the snapshot of the U.S. population, household population at those years of interviewing. But the lifetime experience could be built upon to get, just as we do for cigarette smoking, we get life, you know, when did you first, the age at first of stuff. So there are they're a little bit namby-pamby in their own ways, but they do add a little bit of analytic power towards the trajectory idea. And with a survey like the NSFG, which has histories for a number of domains, we can't afford to add too much history for other domains. But at the same time, there are probably simple things, which I'd love to hear more about, you know, as we get on into this afternoon and from what happened yesterday as well, things that could leverage what we already have to be able to add just a little bit more that could be used to look at how did early, you know, juvenile experience relate to current risk levels and so forth, risk taking.
Okay, I'm getting lots of different cues about lunch, time, so forth. John, short.
Sure.
Emily.
David, I think David has a question.
Oh, David, did you have a David, John, and Emily, you're going to end us. All short, please.
So one survey you haven't looked at is the American Community Survey, which does sample, and now that I'm not at Census, I can say these things. It does sample the institutional population. They have disability, the sixth set of disability questions that you can look for people in prisons and jails. And there is precedence where you could do a follow-on survey for the ACS for a very, very restricted population. And these have been set you can do them. And so that's another, if you really want to push this idea of why don't you do it for everybody, why don't you include everybody in your survey, that's the survey you're going to have to shoot for.
To pile on with the trajectory, the discussion yesterday about unexplained variants and the effects, if we were talking about traumatic events, we would be looking at resilience and coping. I've heard none of that discussed here, and if we're going to look at a broader thing, we ought to look at the things, the covariates, the things that affect, intervene between the experience and the
So I hate to be the one that's ending us off, but I mean, I think one of the things that I've been reflecting on through the course of the last few days is the last 2 days is really, you know, something that Arthur brought up, which is these household-based surveys set our national priorities from a government standpoint, from a population standpoint, and from a funding standpoint. And as of yet, we don't include, you know, incarcerated populations, don't have measures, you know, firm ones, especially in Haines, with direct measures of disease on the ever-incarcerated, the recently incarcerated. There's no kind of measure. And so to me, I mean, I think that that's part of the reason why these studies feel important, both as a physician, as someone that takes care of these individuals, and thinking about, I very much understand that it's a 1% of the population. If you look at, you know, African Americans, it might be 2 to 3%. And so it's, you know, increasingly growing. But if there is the possibility or plausibility of including a measure that at least, you know, because I would say that I get that incarceration is episodic, but there also might be kind of enduring attributes that, you know, when we talk about this life course, the trajectory, what a felony conviction does to a person, that there are some key characteristics that classify the experience of incarceration that might make us at least lean towards thinking about the value of adding measures of a broader namby-pamby measure, but at least one that gets at these core issues and starts, again, that conversation. So,
thank you. Please join me in thanking this group for inviting us.
We're ready to take a lunch break. I think we should come back at 1:15, given the time we have, unless you think you can. What does everybody think? 1:15, good. Okay, Agnes has the lunch cards. She's got the blue cards that will help you get your lunch that's on the second floor. And sign the form before you go through the line. Thank you so much.
Third floor.
Excuse me, third floor.